But this is the story of Duncan McCall. And if you recognize that name, it's still attached to the name of a church here in our little St. Croix Valley. Kirk McCall, over in St. Stephen. Now, Kirk McCall Church, as it is now, is it's not the same denomination that Duncan McCall would have worked for, but it is that particular church is named after him. The Kirk part of its name is actually just the Scottish word for church. So it's Kirk McCall. Sometimes you say Kirk McCall Church, but that's a little redundant because you're just saying church twice if you do that. Named after this guy. Let's take a look at the scripture passages first. The first one here is 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 1 and 2, and verse 5. This immediately precedes the scripture reading I just did for you a few minutes ago, speaking about some of the difficulties of ministry and Paul's attitude towards it. He says, "Therefore, since through God's mercy we have this ministry, we do not lose heart. Rather, we have renounced secret and shameful ways. We do not use deception, nor do we distort the word of God. For what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake." I just thought this was a passage that, as you'll see, kind of sums up Duncan McCall's way of doing ministry, which was to focus on the gospel of Jesus Christ himself. He would run into other ministers coming through the area every now and then, which would tend to kind of preach themselves or preach their particular doctrinal system over against all others. And Duncan McCall never got into that. He said, "I'm here to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ and only that." The other one is Acts chapter 20, verses 28 to 30. This is the Apostle Paul again speaking to the elders of the church in Ephesus. And I chose this one because part of Duncan McCall's ministry here is that he, for the decades he was here, he was really the one faithful minister who kind of held the line for solid gospel Christianity over against some other opinions that were coming in and trying to make inroads. And he was the force that kept good biblical Christianity growing in this area. It says, "Keep watch over yourselves and all the flock of which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. Be shepherds of the church of God, which he bought with his own blood. I know that after I leave, savage wolves will come in among you and will not spare the flock. Even from your own number, men will arise and distort the truth in order to draw away disciples after them. So be on your guard." That's Acts 20, 28 through 31. So let's talk a little bit about Duncan McCall. Some of you might know a little bit of the outline of his story already. I first learned about him doing some research for this church's history. And if you go back far enough, this guy is sort of the ministry roots of the whole area, from which everything else came out, including contacts with the Baptist movement towards the end. His ministry ends just sort of as the story of the Baptists here in Calais starts getting going. This isn't a picture of him necessarily, but that's a picture of a Methodist clergyman, a circuit rider is what he was called. Back when the Methodists were starting out, they would often go out to frontier areas like this. This was a frontier area, and since there were no churches and no pastors, you would have one guy and a horse, and he would ride around everywhere to each little village and give a presentation of the gospel. And so Duncan McCall did a lot of this sort of thing. The box there for just his basic facts. Duncan McCall, you see his dates there, 1754 to 1830, was among the earliest settlers of St. Stephen, New Brunswick, and for most of his life he single-handedly evangelized and provided pastoral care for many communities in eastern Maine and western New Brunswick. Among his many other notable accomplishments, he famously succeeded in preventing the violence of the War of 1812 from affecting the close-knit communities of Calais and St. Stephen, despite the presence of American and British Army units in both towns. We'll talk a little bit more about this, but think about it, that's pretty incredible. That we here, right in our town, that town right across from us, became enemy territory. And it could have broken out in warfare right here. But this one man basically said, "No, we're not going to do that here. We're neighbors with each other. We're going to keep the peace." And he did it. And then here's the testimony of Reverend I.C. Knowlton, one of the early historians of this area. Reverend Duncan McCall was one of the most remarkable and influential men that ever dwelt in the St. Croix Valley. Hardy, resolute, intelligent, and pious, his name is interwoven with all the early life of St. Stephen and Callis, and the impression he made in both towns is too deep ever to be effaced. So, he's quite a guy. I have kind of the outline of his story in the other anecdotes here. I'm going to go through and tell you the story and add to it. We won't read all of this word for word, but I wanted to give you the basic shape of it there in case you wanted to take it with you. But let me start with where he came from. He was actually born in Scotland. He's not only Scottish by ancestry, his family itself is from Scotland. Born there in the 1750s into a nominally religious family. So like a lot of folks growing up in England, Scotland in those days, you were Christian in the sense that your family went to church at least sometimes, and you were baptized in the church, and you mentally ascribed to certain beliefs. Everyone would have said, yes, I believe in Jesus, I believe in God. But that didn't necessarily mean that you had really committed your life to following Christ. There was a lot of what we would just call cultural Christianity back in the day. And Duncan McCall, his family seems to have been, some of his family members were faithful believers, others were just sort of nominal Christians. But he, from a very early age, showed a real interest in religious life. There's one story in his memoirs where he's reflecting back, and he said he thought he was 3 years old when this happened. I don't even have any memories of myself as a three-year-old. But he said he can vividly remember when he was 3 years old, one of his father's business associates died, and they went to the funeral, and he saw this guy being put into the ground, and talked to his parents, and you know, that first awareness of what death is, and that we have to face this passage called death, really gripped the mind of this poor three-year-old boy. And he tells in his memoirs about how he can still remember wrestling with terror at this idea that one day he would die and he would be put in a box in the ground, just like that guy that he had seen. And then he said that he remembers hearing an inner voice that said to him, "But there is a God that will raise you from death in the grave." And it calmed his spirit as a three-year-old kid. And he kind of clung onto that for the rest of his life. So he grew up, he became a young man, he got involved in some financial work like his father had before him, and eventually enlisted as a pay sergeant in the British Army. Now this is in the 1770s, so unfortunately this good guy that we're talking about was one of the bad guys in our national life. He was a British redcoat back in the American Revolutionary War. Signed on as a British soldier, and he was deployed first to Nova Scotia and then here to Maine. Because early on in the Revolutionary War, Britain was trying to kind of cut off Maine from the rest of the colonies. Maine was a district of Massachusetts at the time. And they were hoping to create what they called the province of New Ireland in Maine, sort of as a buffer zone between the colonies and Nova Scotia. Obviously, it didn't work out, but Maine was very sparsely settled back then, so they thought, well, maybe we can just grab this piece of land no one's on and make a beachhead here. So they came down and they built a fort on Castine, the town of Castine, Maine. It's one of these peninsulas down near the far mouth of the Penobscot River, down into the bay there. And so the British Army entrenches on this fort. I'm going to tell you a little bit about this battle because it's one of the most phenomenal stories in Duncan McCall's life. He is a pay sergeant in the British Army, which means he's in an administrative role. And he kind of rises in the ranks until he's one of the helpers to the British colonel who's overseeing the whole battlefield. And the American revolutionaries, they hear about this encampment, they send up a massive naval force from Boston. 44 ships of war sail up into the harbor of Castine to try to get the British out of there. And they send up an artillery unit that's headed by none other than Paul Revere himself. And so all of a sudden this British unit is under siege. They're trying to hold out there. They get word out. They're trying to wait for a British fleet to arrive and give them some relief. Until then, they have to hold out. And so the battle is going on all around the fort that they've built. And at one point, the colonel says to Duncan, I need you to run out and take this message to the captain in the field. I forget exactly what the message was, but it was some kind of important battlefield instruction in the thick of the fight. And so Duncan McCall takes this note and runs down towards the battlefield, and as he reaches it, he realizes that he is in just immensely grave danger. Because the American Revolutionary Force had gained the top of this rise opposite to where he was. He was also on the top of a rise. And down below were the British captain and his forces, kind of stuck in this ravine. And so Duncan McCall realizes he has to run down this trail in open view of the American lines over here that are just going to open fire on him. And that's what happens. He starts running for all he's worth. The American lines see him and they shoot off a volley. You know, back in that day, you just had an entire line of soldiers. They would get their guns up all at once. Everybody shoot at once. Volley shoots at him. He talks about feeling bullets whizzing past him. One went through his hat, one went through the sleeve of his coat, bouncing off rocks around him. Nothing hit him. The American leader gave an order to fire again. They fired a second volley at him. Bullets whizzing all around him. Nothing touched him. The American leader gives the order to fire a third time, and the bullets fly out, and everything's going past him. Nothing hits him. And he's still running. He's down toward, maybe halfway down at this point. And then he sees the American lines. They drop their guns. They start focusing back on the British soldiers again in the bottom. So he's home clear. Now here's, I'm going to jump ahead in his story a little bit to tell you about this, because this is the neatest part. many years later, after Duncan McCall is a pastor, he is traveling down through Maine with Reverend Jesse Lee, an important Methodist evangelist, and they're stopping in different places as they go, and they stop in Blue Hill, and they were preaching there, and they're put up in the house of someone called the Colonel. And so they're enjoying hospitality from this man, and the man starts telling old war stories. He's called the Colonel because he was a Revolutionary War colonel, right? And he doesn't realize that Duncan McCall was also a soldier. He starts telling this story. He says, "You'll never believe, I was once in command of a unit just down here in Castine, Maine, that was trying to take over a British entrenchment. And there was this one young boy that was running down the hill, right in plain view. And I told my soldiers, line up, let's take that guy out. And we shot three volleys at him. We could not hit that man." And then he said, "And then I told my men, put down your guns. The Lord has a special plan for that boy." So what a remarkable story of the providence of God looking over Duncan McCall. And he didn't hear sort of the other side of that story until he was in his 50s, much later on. But he persevered through this. The Battle of Castine, if you know about it, actually ended in a British victory. The British fleet ended up coming up in time, and the American fleet was kind of crushed between the river and this British fleet coming on. It was a terrible naval disaster, one of the worst naval disasters in U.S. history, and the poor American soldiers had to hoof it through the woods back down to Massachusetts. That was the main battle that Duncan McCall was in, and it left an indelible mark on him because of some of the violence that he saw, because of the way he had seen some of his friends lose their lives. It's a common wartime experience, unfortunately. Anyway, as he's a soldier, he's placed different places. He's placed in New York for a while. New York was in British hands throughout most of the American Revolution. He's placed down in Jamaica for a while. That's another British headquarters. And while he's going through this experience of being a soldier in the Revolutionary War, he's starting to think more and more about questions of faith, of religion, and especially of what he calls experimental religion. Now, he doesn't mean by that what we mean by experimental, which is just like you experiment with Buddhism and you experiment with Islam. Now, for him, experimental religion, back in older English, meant, well, we would use the word experiential religion. That is to say, that faith isn't just up here. It's not going to church on Easter and Christmas and saying, yes, I believe in Jesus. It's something you experience in your life, this relationship with Jesus Christ. And he eventually gave his life to Christ in 1781. The war was winding down by that point. He was headed back up to Nova Scotia, and his ship got into a pretty significant storm. Was blown off course, and it landed in Bermuda, which, yeah, probably a nice tropical island, not a bad place to wash up if you're coming out of a storm. And he meets there this lovely young lady from Philadelphia, a Methodist lady. Now, the Methodists back then were sort of the wild-eyed, front-edge, leading-the-charge evangelical Christians who were preaching the gospel everywhere they could go. And this young lady, sometimes people thought they were just too radical. This young lady, she was the daughter of a very wealthy family in Philadelphia, but she was actually being disinherited because she was a Methodist. And her parents didn't think that was respectable. And so she, it says something about her courage. I don't actually know a lot about her part of the story, but it says something about her courage that she was willing to stick with this belief in Jesus Christ and a life shaped by faith, even though it meant losing a family fortune. Anyway, she and Duncan meet, they fall in love, they get married. They moved to Nova Scotia first and then to St. Andrews. Now, we all know St. Andrews, a lovely, beautiful town. Back then, it was not a lovely, beautiful town. It was just getting going. Duncan McCall describes coming there and seeing British veterans trying to kind of eke a living out of this territory and living in bark huts and kind of just pretty impoverished circumstances. Because remember, this whole area was still frontier land, wasn't widely settled. He's in St. Andrews, and then they get an opportunity to move to St. Stephen, which had just been founded, 1785. It was a business venture at that time. He was asked to take the reins of a business some guy had started. So he and his wife move up here. Duncan had been a businessman previously, but it didn't quite work out the way he had been promised. They were kind of left holding the bag for a venture that was not worth anything. And so they find themselves here, right across the river, St. Stephen, New Brunswick. And this is where Duncan McCall's life takes a turn. He and his wife are dedicated Christians, but they come to this area and they realize there aren't any churches here. There aren't any pastors here. You know, Callis was at the very earliest stages. I'm not even sure if there was anyone here. I think it's really 1790 or so that the very first settlers start coming to this side of the river. So McCall says to himself, well, there's no ministry here. Let's start a ministry. So he and his wife start a Bible study in their own house. And all of a sudden, people realize, oh, there's a church service on offer. They start coming out. And pretty soon, Duncan McCall finds himself being the kind of unofficial pastor of a church that's operating out of his house every single Sunday. And he is not satisfied even with that. He says, look, I'm in the middle of this kind of vast territory. Charlotte County is very sparsely settled. Washington County, very sparsely settled. But there are little communities here, strung out. And people living in them who need ministry, who need someone proclaiming the gospel in their lives. And so he wasn't ordained. He wasn't a pastor. He wasn't even formally associated with the Methodists at this point. He just said, well, Lord, if there's a need, I will do it. And so he got on his horse and he started riding, and he rode all over western New Brunswick and all over eastern Maine. And he would go, I don't know how much time he spent on his horse and on foot getting to these places, but the stories that come from it are pretty remarkable. Just to reach places, this was an age where there weren't really established roads or bridges, so he would have to ford rivers on his own, find places along the river where you could walk across somehow. During the winter time, he would still ride out to these distant settlements, and there are stories of the snow being so deep in places that his horse can't make it through. And so Duncan McCall has to get off his horse, break a trail for his horse through the snow, and then keep going. These kinds of labors. And he's doing this. He's not an official pastor. He's not being paid a salary by anybody. And these are just settlers who often don't have a lot of money of their own. So he's paid in just whatever they have on hand to give back to him. There's one kind of amusing story about where he somehow got all the way down as far as Addison, on the other side of Machias, by horse or by foot. And he was ministering down there in that area. And they didn't have any money to give him for his work. And so in order to pay him back, the ladies gave him 50 pounds of hard cheese, you know, those giant rings of hard cheese they used to make in the old days. And so the story is that Duncan McCall has to hike back from Addison all the way up through to Robinson with these 50 pounds of cheese on his back until he can finally get a boat to take him the rest of the way home to St. Stephen. But the time and the energy and the effort he put into the ministry in these places is just remarkable. He is credited with being one of the very first people to introduce the Methodist movement to St. John, New Brunswick, and to Fredericton, New Brunswick, really being one of the main players to sort of get that denomination on the ground here. It was one of the very first ones to reach out and preach the good news in this area. So basically all of western New Brunswick was in his parish, and a good deal of Washington County here in eastern Maine. He himself favored the Methodists. That was sort of his background. But he does mention several places that Baptists and Quakers also rated highly with him. But in general, when he talks about this sort of thing, he says, look, I am for the gospel of Jesus Christ. It doesn't matter what particular name is on the label of your denomination. If you preach the gospel of Jesus Christ, we are brothers. And that's what he stood for. He considered himself a Methodist, but he actually never was formally under their denominational system. He was just sort of a free-range pastor doing his thing out here. And in fact, I have some quotes here. If you flip over to the back page, quotes from Reverend Duncan McCall. Look at some of these under the heading On Denominationalism. He says, I consider myself a member of the mystical Church of Christ and connected with the whole church, and I intend to encourage the faith wherever I find it. I have nothing to do in this world but to promote the welfare of men and the glory of God on earth. Such has been and such is now my situation. In the Christian religion, I firmly believe and intend to follow it. I feel love and goodwill to all the faithful in Christ, for I consider them as a family which ought not to be divided, and I long for that day when there will be but one fold and one shepherd. And the other two quotes there make pretty much the same point, that really he says, above all else, I am a Christian. And that is my identity, and we are all part of one body, which is a kind of a marvelous thing. And I think, at least to a small degree, some of the roots of that spirit have remained in this area, that we are in an area where, not always, but to a large degree, churches will partner together to work on things. You know, our ecumenical food pantry is a partnership between many different churches. It doesn't necessarily matter the name on the front of the church, as long as you are a follower of Christ Jesus and willing to work with us in the labor of doing good for the sake of Christ. And that goes back to Duncan McCall's attitude in ministry. I have this picture there on the back page. That's a picture that is taken from an old Methodist book of the account of Reverend Jesse Lee's ministry trip through New England. This is a view of the city of Boston, back as it looked in 1795, looking down from Beacon Hill. And I included this picture because this was a ministry tour that Duncan McCall was a part of. He hadn't been ordained for the ministry, but he had been doing this great work here in this frontier region. And so Jesse Lee, who is this very famous Methodist evangelist from back then, some historians call him the Apostle to New England, they decided to do this ministry tour together. And they were going to go all the way from Maine, all the way down through to Connecticut, from one end of New England to the other. In Connecticut, they would meet up with Francis Asbury, who is one of the big names in American Christian history. There's still a very prominent seminary named after him. He's the head of all Methodists in North America at the time. And the idea was Duncan McCall would get to be ordained in the ministry by Francis Asbury himself, which is what happened. But McCall tells the story of this journey with Jesse Lee, and they would go, and they, McCall, to meet with Jesse, he started from where he was, stopped in Machias to preach, stopped in Steuben to preach, preached in Blue Hill. That's where the story of his meeting the colonel that we told before comes from. Went down and preached in Portland, went down and preached in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and in Boston, and met figures like Jesse Lee along the way, met the founder of the Shakers down in southern Maine there, and talks about all his encounters. And apparently, his preaching was really appreciated, and people got excited about his messages. There's one story about how there was even a very prominent judge in, I think it was in southern Maine or New Hampshire, who was an avowed deist. A deist was kind of a denominational opinion at that time who believed in God, but not necessarily in the particulars of Christianity. Believed in a God who had created the world and wanted us to be good, but not necessarily much more than that. And apparently he was so convicted by Duncan McCall's preaching that he converted and became a Christian converted to biblical, faithful Christianity. And Duncan McCall even received some interest from big churches down in this area. I mean, southern New England at that time was very different from this area here. Still is today in a lot of ways. But, you know, huge mega churches down there, at least for their standards back then. And he consistently said no. He said, no, I don't want to pastor in this kind of setting. The phrase he particularly said was he wanted to preach in a place where there was a hunger for the word. He wanted to be in a place where he could be of real service. In fact, I think he says that here. Let's see. Do I have? Yeah, the bottom quote on the last page. He says, my constant object is to preach practical Christianity to a people destitute of the word. And that says a lot about his character, doesn't it? And here's someone who, you know, he's doing this really tiresome, backbreaking ministry for almost no pay out in the wilds, and he could have chosen a very different life for himself. But he says, no, this is where God has called me to be. This is where God has called me to preach. This is the flock he has given me to care for. So that is what I will do. In this period of the early 1800s, I didn't include this story on your sheet, but it's one that appears in his memoirs. His wife took gravely ill and was on the point of passing away. And they were over there in their house, and she was basically on her deathbed. And family and friends had gathered around, and they didn't expect that she was going to make it through the night. She would have been still, you know, middle-aged at this point, so it would have been something of an early death. Duncan McCall recounts in his memoirs that as he was in the room next door, kind of waiting and praying, he felt this impulse to go in and lay hands on his wife to heal her. And his response, I mean, you know, he's a Methodist, he's a New Englander from the early 1800s. He was kind of like, I'm not necessarily comfortable with that. So he kind of tried to shove the thought aside. But there's this inner voice that seemed to say to him, brought to mind the story of Jesus healing Peter's mother-in-law in the Gospels. And if you remember that story, Jesus touches Peter's mother-in-law, and the fever that had struck her down vanishes instantly. She pops back up and starts serving people. This story was brought to mind to Duncan McCall as he's pacing out there, and a voice seems to say to him, when Jesus healed Peter's mother-in-law, did that power to heal him come from his body or from his spirit? And McCall, who had kind of said to the Lord, healings were something Jesus did back then. It doesn't happen anymore. Well, when this question came up, Duncan McCall said, well, Lord, it was his spirit. And the voice seemed to say to him, his spirit is still here with you. If it was the spirit of Jesus Christ that had power to heal her then, does he not have the same power now? And so Duncan McCall says, okay. And according to the story, he kind of sneaks back in the room, doesn't tell anyone else there what has been going through his mind, just walks up to his wife's bed and puts his hand on her leg, and she immediately revives. She opens her eyes. She coughs a little bit. She asks for some water. And they bring her some water, and she starts talking. And she comes back from the brink of death. Quite a story of healing, isn't it? We don't see those things often, but we believe in God's power to heal in marvelous ways. So his wife was able to remain with him in ministry for a few more years. Then we come to the War of 1812. If you remember your old American history classes, War of 1812 is Britain versus the USA, round two. And Canada still was not Canada. It was a dominion of Great Britain. And so this became the battleground. This became the international border between two hostile powers. If you know your local history, you know that Eastport actually was captured and held by the British for several years during the 18-teens. And there's an old British barracks down there that you can go look at in Eastport if you're so interested. But here's what happened. As soon as the declaration of war came out, Duncan McCall gathered a meeting of the leaders of both towns together. And he said, look, folks, I've preached to both of you. I've baptized all of you. I've married a number of you, performed marriages. Some of you married each other, in these different towns. We're family. We're neighbors. I don't think we want to fight each other here. And they said, no, we don't. So he said, we are going to make that stand known to the military when they come down here that the war may not be prosecuted in our towns. And this is what they did. One Sunday, as he was having church over here in Calais, an American Army officer came in the back and sat down. And Duncan McCall finished the service and went to talk with him. And this man, happily, actually was a Methodist himself. And Duncan McCall said, look, sir, we respect you. We wish you the best. But we here in this town, we are neighbors with those across the river. We're not going to fight each other. We would like it if you would leave us to manage civic order here in the St. Croix Valley and prosecute the war elsewhere. And the army commander said, that sounds good to me. And when the British Army commander showed up on the other side in St. Stephen, Duncan McCall went and did the same thing, had a meeting with him, and they said, okay, we'll leave this place in your guys' hands and just keep the peace and you won't have any trouble. So that's what they did through the entire war, where technically they are enemies of each other. They kept the peace here. In fact, there's one fantastic story, which maybe you've heard, that comes from that period of the War of 1812, where the British Army had left some weapons and gunpowder supplies over there for the defense of St. Stephen against the Americans, right? Well, St. Stephen had decided not to be a part of this war, and Calais likewise. And so what they decided to do was, well, hey, we've got all this gunpowder. St. Stephen gave the gunpowder to Calais so that they could make some fireworks to celebrate the 4th of July. Isn't that great? So, you know, today when we have our international festival and the town leaders meet and shake hands, we have really impressively deep roots to that relationship. And the friendship, the ties of friendship between our towns goes all the way back to the Christian ministry of the churches and this man and the way he kind of held it together. There's a quote on the back about the end of the war of 1812. This is the second quote under the heading on war and patriotism. He says, "The news of peace came to us at the end of the war of 1812, and now what cause of happiness, of thankfulness, and of praise to God for our preservation? Not $1 worth of property was taken by violence from any man on the lines, neither was there any killed, wounded, or taken prisoner amongst us. But in room of judgments we have had wonderful works of grace, such as we never saw in this country before." Kind of a marvelous story of the power of the Christian gospel to maintain peace, even in the midst of hatred and war and violence. Towards the end of that war, 1814, we're getting down towards the bottom of the second page here. In 1814, as the war was winding down, a revival broke out in the Christian communities where McCall ministered, adding many new believers to the faith in Calais and St. Stephen. He tells a story in his memoirs where they were gathered together in the little church they had kind of thrown together in St. Stephen. And there were so many people who had come out in the midst of this revival that they said they realized after the service, the gallery of the church, which I think refers to kind of a raised section of seating. They said they realized afterwards that the gallery of church had sunk 3 to 4 inches into the ground because there had been so many people out to church that day. Thankfully, it didn't collapse. But a marvelous response to the gospel. McCall would go on to minister for another 15 years in this area until he was in his 70s. He was still doing it. He's still riding out to all these different communities and preaching, all here on our side of the border, on the other side of the border, going to all the different towns. He had kind of a different relationship with every town, but he would always minister the gospel there. Some towns he felt like it was really hard work to preach the gospel in them. For some reason, St. David over in New Brunswick gave him a really hard run for his money. Here in Calais, in around 1816, there was another minister who came in, and McCall was happy to have other pastors, but unfortunately, this guy kind of turned it into sort of a bitter feud and drew off a bunch of people, and then kind of there was some backbiting going on in town by those who had left. Always a difficult thing when churches split and there's animosity there. But Duncan McCall kind of persevered, plodded through his ministry wherever he was needed. He kept on preaching. I told you the story of his wife on the deathbed the first time. There's another story about when she actually passes away. This is around 1820, I don't have the exact date. When she actually passes away, there's this marvelous story of her lying on her deathbed, and Duncan is there beside her. And she seems very close to going, and then she revives a little bit, and Duncan asks her, how do you feel? And she says, "I feel so happy. I felt a moment ago as if I were there, and I could hear singing such as I've never heard before." And just a moment later, she slipped away, but it seemed like she had gotten this taste of the courts of heaven and reawakened for a moment to tell Duncan about it, and then passed away. And he was very honest in his memoirs how deeply he missed her, but he kept on going. Here he is in his 60s and his 70s, still breaking trails in the wintertime for his horse to walk behind him so that he can get out to these communities and preach. In fact, one of the last stories comes from Baring. He had come over to Baring to preach in that town in the wintertime, and they were just walking across the river on the ice, and on the way back across from Baring, he had a couple guys with him. The ice cracked, and he slipped off the horse and kind of fell halfway into the river before he could grab on. And you know, they're hauling this 70-year-old never say die pastor out of the water, and he kept going. The exact words he said was, "I was a marvel to many that day," that he survived and that he kept on going. It wasn't long after that, though, 1830, he passes away, and just shortly before then, he had kind of handed the reins of his ministry over to the Methodist denomination in this area, and a new pastor had come in and began preaching and ministering the gospel of peace that he had begun proclaiming. So I just finished reading his memoirs this past week, and I wanted to share his story with you, of just the way that God used this remarkable man of God to plant seeds of faith here in our own hometown, seeds that I think we can say are still bearing fruit even today.